Welcome to the Practice Podcast, conversations probing the nature of practice. I'm your host, Dave Fearon, co-author with Peter Vail of the digital book on Practice as a Way of Being. Find it at mylibrary.world. And now to our show. The week that I've had this conversation with Paul Crick is the week I'm going to post a wait a minute about the nature of practice. I'll tell you in advance, it's about surprise. It's about being surprised. If you're in practice, you're not quite certain what's going to come ahead and if you're ready for it, what you're going to discover or what you're going to let go. It's an adventure. And so surprise is a big word for me helping you understand and myself understand practice. Well, that's what this conversation brings for me. Surprise after surprise after surprise with Paul, because he's so thoughtful, can connect an idea or a question with what he's read or someone he's met who had a real influence in his thinking. So it was a rich conversation, full of surprises. I had seen Paul once co-moderating a webinar a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, wow, I like his style, but that's all I knew. Now, at the end of this conversation, as I record this introduction, I'm thinking, I want more. I want to get back and have another conversation with Paul Crick. We just got into the meat of something he's doing in the area of leadership, and it seems so compatible with what I've thought and believed and what Peter Vail thought and believed. Of course, I like it that way. If he were incompatible with me, that'd be a nice surprise too, because I'd have to shift my thinking. So these podcast conversations are my practice, one of my practices, and I love it because surprise! Paul Crick. Paul Crick, just as I start these conversations, particularly with someone where it's the first one-on-one conversation, I ask Paul Crick, well, how should I introduce you? Because if you look at his profile, and it's linked in the description, you'll see that he has a continuity of interest in leadership and management. Yes, but also I just learned, maybe I saw a glimpse of that, classical music. So welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Is there a connection? Because when a body of music becomes a classical body of music, it means that it's finished. Or is it? Because I think I can segue into something about leadership in a minute, but is it done and finished just because Beethoven finished it in 18 whatever?
My answer to that would probably be not. I don't think leadership is a destination. I think it's a journey and a process. Mm-hmm. And I think the key is to be curious about where that's going and to be led by your own curiosity as to where you want to go.
When Beethoven or Mozart or any of those whose music we consider classics wrote the last note, you know, and then handed it over to a copyist, did they feel it was finished? Or do you think that they had in their imagination that their music would be played many times and probably with little nuances, according to each arranger and composer, that made it different? And or the audience would be different listening to it 20 years, 100 years from now. Because I'm teasing along with this notion that when is something really finished when it is so important to the world that people keep bringing it up?
I think it's interesting, isn't it? Depends how you choose to view music. One of the recent epiphanies, I mean, it's kind of obvious really, but because of the work I'm doing, it was a penny that dropped for me particularly, which was the idea that music doesn't exist on paper. Music is just dots. But music notation exists on paper.
Yeah.
Music and it's an expression of desire and intent by the person who put them there. And that desire and intent probably changed day to day, week to week, month to month.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, the music is, you can read Debussy, you can read Mozart, variations on the idea of music is the spaces in between.
Yeah.
And the spaces are always moving.
Music
also is a system. You know, it's the performer, it's the audience, it's the room in which the performance takes place. It's the energy, it's the mechanics of the instrument, it's the placement of the dots, it's the remembering, it's the forgetting, it's the reading, it's the misinterpretation, it's the taking license with. In today's modern computer music driven world, it's the sampling of the thing. What was it that there's a great thing that a British comedian called Bill Bailey does, which is an introduction to the orchestra. I've forgotten the exact title of it. But he essentially strips back a piece of music to uncover that the bassoon line is the same as one of the Bee Gees songs, which I love. I love, because that just tickles my intellect. And I just go, how on earth did you discover that? I think the song is I am a Woman in Love. But it's deep rooted in this bassoon line of this classical piece. And you just go, oh, I just love that. And I love it when I hear, what was it? I heard a song. I wasn't very well over Christmas. I had a really bad cold sort of virus thing that took a long time to shake.
Oh, yeah.
But the advantage of that is you get time to listen and to read, even though you feel not very well under the covers. You're still listening to podcasts and watching videos, reading stuff when you're not sleeping. And I discovered there was a piece of Shania Twain music off her latest album called Giddy Up. The song's called Giddy Up. And it's got the same guitar rhythm as the hand jive from Greece. And I just love doing that.
Hand jive.
Yeah. And people who do these musical mashups of videos, you know, where you've got Laurel and Hardy dancing to AC/DC, you know, a track by AC/DC, and you just go, oh, it's just love that. So a long answer to the question is no, I don't think the music is ever done. I think it is a statement that is then there to inspire, to guide, and to spark the human experience in others.
Now, here's my cheap leap.
Cheap leaps are good.
I think leadership is just as you said.
Well,
I think it has many of those qualities. It, as most original music, comes from one person. But that person has an intention to transcend herself or himself. Maybe for a buck, who knows, or because there's a patron or whatever the reason, they know that they've got to get it out. And, but once it's out there, whatever the original statement was or behavior or whatever may have caught the attention of others, I think it gets picked up on as almost a little bit of a theme that kind of unwinds and moves out. And if you see, as in me, a lot of what Peter Vail was to me as a young and willing learner, it's true. And I could take the 50 years between then and when Peter and I worked together on his last book, and I'd say, yeah, that day I was putting that veilism out there. Wait a minute, though. This one is a fear-on-ism, because that popped up 6 months or a year later. And it came back to me and I said, yeah, I said the same thing. Now, that could be just ego working. But don't you get that sense that maybe there's a similarity between one's intention to make music and make people follow?
Well, that's an interesting question because I'm not sure I would say that's what we're trying to do. It's such a loaded word, follow.
Yeah, I know. I as soon as I said that word.
So the old English, sorry, the old German origin of the word to lead is Leiden, and Leiden means to go with or to travel. And I like that as a sort of, yeah, what we're trying to do is we're trying to encourage people to go with us and with each other. I've studied martial arts seriously for the last 6 years. And the thing I'm learning is that the whole thing is an exchange. Yeah. I want you to go with me. You want to come with me, but you also want to influence where I go. And therefore, you know, if you work at energetic levels, and I know that's woo-woo for some people,
No.
but the science is there. If you work at energetic levels, essentially you're working with people's energy. You know, if you get into the ideas of homeostasis and allostasis, then people are making calculations about, you know, is it worth me? Is the payoff worth investing the energy it will take to get out of bed and go to work this morning and sit with my colleague and thrash something out, or you know, try and come up with something, or to serve a customer, or whatever that is. So I think there are definitely parallels. I think there are things that we don't yet recognize, and I think it takes sometimes a parallel jump into a different discipline to help you see that, much the same way as, well, art generally, you know, art helps, you know, whether it's poetry, whether it's painting, whether it's music, whether it's sculpture, pottery, whatever it is, it makes you look at the world or think about something in a slightly different way. And I think that's what's important right now, given where we are.
What was that German word again? I want to be sure I get it.
Leiden. So it's L, and then I don't know how you pronounce the character, but it's essentially an A and an E. So it's an A, but the E is written backwards. I'll have to find out what that is.
I love it.
It's Leiden, is how I pronounce it. And I think that's correct, but I'm happy to be wrong. Which means to travel with. And I think that's lovely, because we are here, I think, to travel with each other. I'm reminded of a very famous Aboriginal saying that was picked up and used by the late Queen Elizabeth, who said, "The purpose of life is to learn to love and to be loved and to take and to show each other the way home." And I think that's just beautiful. And that's the idea of showing each other the way, that traveling together, gave me a lot of peace and comfort in a life that can be challenging in many different ways. And I just felt grounded and rooted whenever I think of that. I go, yeah. Yeah.
I agree. I want to pause on the word home
Sure.
because I started off my rant over at the beginning of the call with, is there such a thing as a finished piece of music? I'm done. It's ready to go for the world. Home is home. Ultimate destination, or is it wherever you are that you feel you're at home, or
I think
both?
there's that. My wife and I had the same conversation only a week ago. We were trying to figure out, well, what is home? I think we concluded it's not a place, though a place can have significance. I think it's much more a connectedness. That quality of connectedness. And if you are connected, doesn't necessarily have to be to another human being, but if you are connected with, I would say, nature, be that human or another animal or the environment you're in, where that you get a sense of something bigger than you. And then for me personally, I take that to be a good description for me of what home is. And I think home for me is more of a feeling than a place.
The traveling idea, if I were to invite people to travel with me, which I think I do every time I post a new podcast, listen, see where this takes you. I like the idea, though, that there's a bit of a promise in that trip, you know, that I have some notion that if we move together, you choose to put energy into our direction, that it's going to take you to a moment in time where you feel more at home than you do now. Because I think that's the deepest longing. Again, yes. From the age now I am well over 80, in imagination at least, I see how important it is at those moments in my life where I had felt settled. It was very important to my wife. Mm-hmm. She wants a nest, and I always was looking up over the edge of the nest to see where else we could fly. But what we came to an agreement was that after almost 60 years of marriage, this is home, mm-hmm. the two of us. And then when the kids come, now well into their 50s,
yeah,
they not just come into this place, because we've talked about, well, what if we have to, what if they make us go to one of those places where
yes.
we don't have, you know, three bedrooms and mm-hmm. land around us anymore. And the answer is, well, we're going to be together. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're good.
Yeah.
So I know I'm kind of going into that level, but I want to come back around though, something that you're involved in. And thank you for co-hosting that session with Mark Bradford on Aikido the other day. In fact, I jumped right on. He's an episode pending, and right. we're going to meet again because he got me so interested. And then I was on an edge walker session the other day. A good friend of mine, Judy Neal, created this idea of how we work between spirit and physicality. And that's the edge that we walk. Anyway, yeah. I had a person on whose first name was Shadrick.
And okay.
I can't think of his last name, but I can tell you this. Mm-hmm. When Shadrick was talking with us about transformational work that they're doing in South Africa, in Africa, the continent, and the world, he said, I've studied Aikido. I've looked at the philosophy of Aikido, along with other Western and other things, to understand what it takes to become transformational. So I thought, wait a minute, I'm hearing this from you, from Mark, from Shadrick. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm on, I feel like I'm on the edge of understanding something. What do you think of that term and the idea behind transformation?
Oh my goodness.
And give me that answer in 25 seconds, please.
Yeah. I was going to say, how long have you got?
I think it's a wonderful promise. I still haven't figured it out yet.
Again, I think it's all part of the process. I think it's, and I think it comes down to personal story then. You know, do you want to transform?
Yeah.
And what is it that is creating the pressure for you wanting to do that? Is it peer expectation? Is it parental expectation? Is it discomfort, dissatisfaction with your circumstance? Is it, you know, you want to somehow make a difference and have an impact in the world? You know, there are as many reasons for transformation as there are in the stars in the sky. So my own journey has been a wonderful journey. If I look back to who I was 10 years ago and where I am now, I'm very happy with the results. And I also know I want to go further. And now I know I am challenged further because it's more, I think looking back, it was more because I had to. I think now it's because I want to.
The big difference, isn't it?
And that's a huge difference because want to, when you have to, not a lot holds you back. You kind of push through and you go, this is hard, this is not easy, but you know, I have something bigger I'm aiming for, therefore I am pulled towards it, or I am pulling that towards me. I always like the idea of the wayfarer navigators of the South Pacific. You know, they don't navigate to something, they bring the thing they want to them. Which I think which is a lovely distinction. And yeah. I love these distinctions that turn our worldview, our Western worldview, upside down. It's kind of like, yeah, there's a different way of being. And the challenge we have is, you know, if you look for the last 70 to 100 years, our way of being in some ways hasn't changed a lot. And we're in a place now where it needs to. And therefore, what are some of the practices? What are some of the views of the world that could be useful, that mess with our heads, that mess with our way of looking at things, that and right. encourage us to step out and say, actually, I want to change, or I have to change.
To that point, I've started a new practice for the podcast, for the work I'm doing on practice itself. I have something called Wait a Minute that I'm doing each Friday. And I just recorded the last one for this coming Friday. And I said, wait a minute, here's something about practice. Surprise!
Yes.
I did that.
Yeah.
And then I went on to say, the reward of uncertainty and moving out into it and exploring and seeing what limits there really are is surprise. And here's the point, though. A lot of people don't like surprise at all. They like to develop such continuity and sameness and regularity, and you know all the words, that they do not want to be surprised. And what I'm saying to your point is, that's one of the things that we need to encourage. That
it is.
Of even being unpleasantly surprised, but surprised. That means you're out there beyond your neck, you know.
And that's where all growth comes from. All growth comes from a degree of discomfort of
yes.
varying colors. Once you've been in that situation, you can't unsee it, you can't unexperience it, and you can't go back. And therefore, I'm always slightly amused by leadership development courses that are taken in a classroom with a PowerPoint and a set of flip charts. It's kind of like,
oh yeah,
that's, I understand why you do that, and there is a little bit of merit, I would say, in doing that, but I can't help feeling that it's experiential. Our learning comes from experience. You learn what you like, you learn what you don't like, you learn what you're capable of, you learn what your gaps of are, and you're able to make decisions and say, not that, but this.
Yeah. See, I think that avoidance of being off balance, all things that come along with surprise, is what's holding us back. I really do. I taught from the time I was 12. I started teaching swimming, little kids on the YMCA, mm-hmm. plastered against the wall, dreading to come into the shallow end of my pool. Mm-hmm. And then seeing them, when you finally coax them up and they get their feet in and they finally get in the water, and it's not all that cold, and they see their friends playing, and then they watch that face going from terror to absolute delight.
Yeah.
And see, I that's been my payoff all these years in various formats. But I want to ask you about that $380 billion. I noticed that I didn't get any of it during that year. I suppose you and your colleagues do. But what is it about all that that's being spent, and it's not apparently moving the needle all that much in corporations or elsewhere?
Just to put it in context, Forbes magazine reported in 2019. I was preparing for a TEDx talk, and I wanted some facts and figures, and they reported that we spent on training leaders $366 billion. Now, I know about you, but that's a number I can't get my head around.
No, that's
I kind of go,
the economy of half the small countries in the world.
well, it is.
It's an awesome thing.
It's at current land prices is the equivalent of buying a 12th of the land of Greater Los Angeles. It's the equivalent of doubling the operational fleet of Boeing jumbo jets in the world today. I did all this math, so it was kind of like, so if it's that, I think in terms of if you look at NASA's budget, total budget for the year, it dwarfs that. And then you look at everything that's happening. You look at, well, at one level, geopolitical tension. If you look at and conflict, if you look at, you bring it down at another level, you look at inequality, you look at gender inequality, you look at economic inequality, and you just look at it and you go, that's not only a poor performance. I just thought that was immoral. How can you spend that money and not get at least a better result? You know, I wouldn't expect a one, a like for like, you know, spend a dollar, get a dollar. But you have to look at it and you say, goodness me, you know, what is going on? And where is it? So the thing I'm curious about is where is the disconnect? And I've taught for IBM. Like you, I've taught a little bit. Well, I've only done a little bit, but I've taught in universities. I'm an assistant instructor at the dojo, so I have a little experience of what teaching is, and I've observed phenomenal teachers, and I've observed teachers that, you know, really need to go back to school. Yeah, just how do we close? What do we close that? And I think it comes down to the experience. You know, there are certain things. There are certain things that if you're going to be certified, you know, if you're going to be a certified neurosurgeon, then I want to make sure you know what you're doing and you know all the technical things and this, that, and the other. But if you're an entrepreneur, you don't need to be certified as an entrepreneur. You need to go start a business, and you need some people around you to support you so that when it gets hard and it gets tough and you're running out of money and your customers aren't saying yes and your sales cycles are going a lot slower than you wanted and your sales velocity isn't as quick as you want, and you know, people let you down, people lie to you, you don't get that in the classroom. You get that by doing it. And there's a phenomenal piece of work by a lady called Dr. Bunny Badenoch. And she is an expert in trauma. And she talks about resilience in a way that I love, which is we are resilient when we have the emotional support needed to pass through an experience and not only to survive that experience, but to flourish from it. And
Emotional support.
yeah. Emotional support. So when it's going wrong, and I talk about this in the dojo, I learned a valuable lesson. It was a wonderful lesson. There is a difference between being thrown to the mat and thrown through the mat.
What?
Yeah, there you get, you can get thrown onto the mat, and that's an experience which, you know, for some people is a scary experience. But you can get through it where it's like a house has fallen on top of you, and you learn to fall safely, and you survive that. And part of the growing experience in martial arts is that you will get given experience, somewhat surprisingly and unexpectedly, that expands your comfort zone, but you are lovingly supported through that in such a way that, okay, we're going to extend the experience. Your comfort zone is going to expand by 6% now. You don't know it's coming, but don't worry, we've got you. We've got your back. And you might look stupid, you might get hurt, you might pull a face. It's okay. The thing is you've been through that and we're there to support you. And we don't do that in leader development enough.
No, we just tell them that it's really, really going to hurt when you hit the mat. So pull yourself in, avoid all surprises,
Yeah.
Keep the conflict levels low, smooth it, you know, and see, I'm speaking from an American business school experience.
Yeah.
Used to, and so was Peter Bale. Mm-hmm. We both had the same angst, which mm-hmm. is that there's a notion out there and it lingers that management equals control.
Yeah.
And that managers control, and that being in control is okay from a quality standpoint. I get it. You know, you flip the dials. AI is going to take care of a lot of that. But Peter said in one of our conjectures, as well as in one of our podcasts, he said, you know, what we should be doing is preparing managers to be encouragers, to your point about the dojo. Encouragers. In fact, he split the word, encouragers.
Mm-hmm.
It's the courage of others that moves things forward.
Yes.
And your job as a manager is to help them use that courage to do tough things, scary things, new things. You make the list. And why? Because when you get past, and this is the travel notion again, when we get past that, whatever that impasse may be, I'll still be there with you. And if I'm not there physically, what we've learned together will still be there with you. The encouragement.
It's rendered in your body and you can't forget it. We all can think of teachers that did
yes.
that. And,
yes.
and they are no longer present. They've passed away.
Yes.
And, you know, I think of some of the teachers I've had and I go, and I, if I think back, there was a moment in my master's where I really struggled with the mathematics. You know, I had to learn exploratory factor analysis from scratch.
Mm.
And I had to use SPSS to do it as well with my data. So I'm already out of my depth. but my tutor was fantastic, and I'll never forget sitting with her and one of the statistics professors. And he said, "Well, let's give me the data set and let's just run the model and let's see what we get." So we did that, and it was a moment of discovery that I finally understood why people research. There is a eureka moment where you go, "Oh my goodness, look at that!" and we all looked at each other and went, "Wow." And then my tutor said, "See, I told you you were a grade A student." And I was like, "Whoa." And that has stayed with me forever. Because I was a dunce growing up. I was a late developer. Yeah. I was into sports, and I was always in trouble and doing things I shouldn't be doing.
it's hard to believe that looking at you now, Paul.
Yeah, so there are things like that. And for me, you can be a parent, you can be a spiritual, you can be someone in the church, organized religion, or someone in the community or in your family, or someone that guides you and travels with you. But isn't that what we're aiming for? Isn't the job really about, how do we, as you say, encourage. And embody, help people have experiences that when they come across that situation again, they can do a memory search and they kind of go, "Oh, it's just like when I was with David and we did this.
Yep.
Oh, I'm okay. This will be all right."
I've had the luxury of being able to reach out to former students, and they're all undergraduates in my school and our business school.
Mm-hmm.
And I reach out to them 5, 10 and some in recent time, 20 years later.
Right.
And I have to ask, "Well, what do you remember about my course?"
Yeah.
They don't remember a damn thing.
They don't remember a thing. No.
They said, "But you know, don't you remember that time when you came home to our team and we were stuck?" Mm-hmm. I asked them to take a bunch of what I call stuff off a table, bring it back and create a prototype for a wonderful world-beating business idea that would change the world for the good. And they're sitting there and they had their stuff and their masking tape and everything. And you came over. Other teams were starting to construct stuff. You came over and we thought you were going to say, get going, the clock is running. And you just stood there and then you said, what about that right there? Mm. What could you build around that? I think it was a Tinker Toy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, they used to accuse me of playing too many games with the kids, even though they're in their 20s. But they took the Tinker Toy, looked at it and said, this is a hub.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started to build. And she remembered that almost 20 years later.
And there you go. And she'll have used that.
And every time her kids play, she had little kids, she had a box that had one of those canisters of Tinker Toys.
Nice.
And they'd be shaking them out, and she'd probably come by and have that little reinforced moment thing. A hub, a hub. You see, so I have my eye on the clock, but I have to ask you about the circle, the leadership circle that you've been working.
Yes.
Because now that we've talked about music and all these wonderful things about leadership and encouragement, what does the circle do to move us out of the stuck place that we were in 2019 when Forbes caught us taking money without making a whole lot of difference? Not you, but us, the management leadership educators.
Yeah, it was nothing to do with me. I'm a great leader.
Not me. I'm innocent.
Yeah. So the circle, is a great tool that on a single page shows you what holds you back from your full potential as someone who can accompany someone else or other people on a journey that accomplishes something. On one page as a picture. As a picture. So the circle, if you imagine a top half and a bottom half, I describe it as very simply as it's like driving a car. The top half is the gas pedal. The bottom half is the brake. And we all as human beings drive our human car with one foot on the brake and one foot on the gas pedal at the same time. We always do. It helps keep us safe. It helps us navigate.
That's true. We're always tamping on the brake.
Just give it a little tap. Yeah, always going a bit faster. We tap that. But we've always got a foot resting on the brake. And people assume that in order to go faster, you need to push on the gas pedal. Actually, all you need to do is ease your foot off the brake just a little bit.
Oh, that's too scary, though. That's scary.
But that's where you need the. I'm not saying take your foot off the brake.
No.
I said ease it. So if you've got it full on, I remember the first time we landed in America. It was my parents' 25th wedding anniversary. Why they took us kids, I'm not sure, but I'm so grateful they did. And we landed in San Francisco. As you know, in the UK, we drive on the wrong side of the road. And we also drive stick shifts, as you would call them.
Yes.
And my father got into a car and he was on the wrong side of the car, on the wrong side of the road, and it was an automatic. And of course, there was a pedal missing. So all he had was a gas pedal and a brake pedal. And as he was adjusting, trying to figure his way out of the car park, he'd sort of like push on the brake quite hard. And we'd all sort of jerk backwards and forwards and go, what's going on? And that's how we can drive the vehicle and the structure that is the human being as we navigate the mm-hmm. paths of life. Mm-hmm. And all we need to do is recognize that that's what we do. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't mean that pushing on the brake is a bad thing, because that's what partly got us to where we are now.
Yes, that's control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, instead of playing not to lose, let's play to win instead. Mm. And then what we're saying is we now have an awareness of the brake, not just the gas pedal.
Yeah.
Most of us will just come out and we'll go, right, go. And then we wonder why. And if you did that on a car and you watch the rev counter and it's constantly in the red.
The blue lights start to whirl behind you as you
But what happens to the components in the car? They burn out.
They do.
And that's guess what? That's what we're doing. So that's what the leadership circle does. Gives you an awareness. Where you've got your foot on the brake and it's too heavy, And then we support you through a program of encouraging you to make the small changes that can actually propel you forward a lot faster.
Wow. I love the elegant simplicity of the wheel, of the circle. And it takes a lot of thought to make something that profound, that it holds people, and then you can move them from there. So congratulations on that idea, and I know it's going to help.
No, it's not my idea, it's Bob Anderson's idea, but yes, it's a very powerful tool.
Well, you know, no one's going to listen to this podcast. We can give you full credit for Paul Crick.
Oh,
Bob Anderson. No, I see. There you go. The two of you traveling together.
Yes, right? Very much so.
There you go. Well, this has been wonderful. I really loved it. I'm so glad to have met you when you were co-facilitating with Tom Bohink.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to see Tom this week. He's
okay,
also advising John Hibbs and the Coefficient Initiative.
Great.
You know, we thought of, like, I guess they call us content experts.
Good. Good.
Hey, I'll take it. I have the t-shirt. But I love what you are doing, and the people you get to work with, and now you're helping me be part of that circle too. And I've had a lot to think about in this conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Practice Podcast, Conversations Probing the Nature of Practice. If you'd like to hear more, go to Podomatic, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. And please consider purchasing our book on practice as a way of being at mylibrary.world. It's a digital book with lots of features that you do not see in a conventional book. So once again, thank you, and I look forward to you listening again. Oh, and one more thing. Please check out our webpage at enactionresearch.info.